Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Paul Theroux, novelist, travel writer, short story writer, who has two new books, one just out in trade paper, the other in hardback. The trade paper book is Dark Star Safari, Overland from Cairo to Cape Town, and a collection of short stories called The Stranger at the Palazzo d'Oro, which is out in hardcover at the present time. One of the interesting aspects of the story, lead story, Stranger at the Palazzo d'Oro, is that it was written during the trip that Paul Theroux takes through Africa in Dark Star Safari. Even though the story takes place in Italy, parts of the trip seem to bleed in.
Yes, that's true. What happened was I was on a cruise down the Nile, because my intention was to go from Cairo to Cape Town by land and boat and train and cattle truck and bus and walking. And first part of the trip was going down the Nile, and I bumped into, well, it was a group of rather attractive German women traveling with an Arab doctor, and I just began fantasizing about them, as one does when one's away from home, and then began the story. And I worked on the story all the way through. It started as sort of a novella, which I think of as the perfect literary form, you know, something like Death in Venice or Heart of Darkness. And so I was going to work on it all those months. And as I got into Africa, it got steamier and steamier and steamier as I was repressing my desires. But so it turned into a steamy novella by the time I got to Cape Town.
The premise of it concerns a woman who appears to be in her 30s, but in fact isn't, is a wee bit older, and kind of crumbling, as it were, much like the monuments in Egypt.
That's right, yeah. Ozymandias. Yeah, a ruin, a sort of living ruin. And the young man, he was 22, it's set in Sicily. And I was in Sicily in 63. This is set in 1962, slightly earlier just because of certain age that I wanted. And it's like a lot of Italian movies at the time. Palazzo d'Oro is like a Fellini or Rossellini or De Sica or Antonioni movie, where the young man meets a couple, usually a pleasant, attractive couple, but in the movie, because there were many in the 1950s and 60s, it was always a decadent couple, and the boy would end up with either the man or the woman or the friends or a menage a trois, or, you know, it was just decadent. And these dissipated people would pick up the innocent stranger and, oh, there was one, Knife in the Water, the early Polanski movie.
Yeah.
Boy meets these people, and he thinks in the first paragraph, I want their life. That's what I want. Sitting at a table in Sicily, having lunch, the sun shining. He doesn't have any money. He's an artist. And he thinks that, and he gets their life. I wrote this story in Egypt. I wrote it in the Sudan. I wrote it in Ethiopia, in Uganda, in Tanzania, in Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, and South Africa. So it's a way of passing the time at night in Africa. In Africa, you don't go out at night. It's not a good idea anyway.
The steaminess seems to parallel the physical steaminess that you were going through in your tent or wherever.
Yeah, no tent. I stayed in hovels. I was usually in a very, very crummy $2 hotel.
You actually, I think, did spend one night in a tent, which was on the river.
On the Shiri River, yeah. Just in a borrowed tent, not my own tent. And a canoe. Toward the end of the trip, when I was in Malawi, I had been down the Shiri River and the Zambezi River in, I think, 96, 97. And so I knew the river. I knew that part of the river. And I was just sick of taking buses. So I hooked up with these African friends of mine, and we went down the river. It was the river that David Livingstone went up and down. It's very, very remote. It's hard to find, hard to get down, hard to negotiate. It's full of, you think a river is a river, but this is a river that goes into a marsh. And the marsh has this elephant grass, which is very, very tall, way over your head. So you can't see where you're going. It's a labyrinth. And once you're out of the marsh, it's okay. You're going down a pretty wide river, then into the Zambezi, which is very wide. Then you get to Mozambique, the Mozambique side of it, and you have to get to the coast. It's a saga. You have to read Dark Star Safari to find out how this is done. But that was actually one of the most enjoyable parts of the trip.
Paul Theroux, let's talk a little bit about creating a book like this and also the trips that you took. And then I want to go into some of the politics of what you saw, because that's an ongoing story. on these trips, now, first of all, it's not all the same trip. This is multiple trips that you then turn into a single trip so that when we're reading it, you start in Egypt, in Cairo, and wind up in Cape Town, essentially.
Well, that was one trip. I actually went from Cairo to Cape Town in one trip. I left in January 2001, and I went continuously. The difficulty was the Sudan. I couldn't go by land into the Sudan, so I had to fly. I went down the Nile. I went as far down the Nile as I could, almost to the Sudan border, to Wadi Halfa, and then couldn't. I went to Hurghada after that. I was basically just killing time, trying to get a visa, trying to get permission to go in, couldn't, and eventually flew to Khartoum, and then went up the Nile from Khartoum up to Akbara, and then back, and then I went to Ethiopia, and then by road I went to Harar, where Rambo was not writing poetry, but running guns. I took a train there. I took a bus and a van down to the border, got a cattle truck into Kenya, got shot at, got to Nairobi, took buses, trains, took a boat across Lake Victoria, another train, and went continuously south. Then 9/11 came. That was so. I finished up 5.5 months later. 9/11 occurred, as we know, in 2001, and I thought, well, this is interesting, and this somewhat changes the tenor of the trip. What would it be like? What's South Africa like? In fact, there had been some agitation in Cape Town. I had been through Sudan and Egypt. I thought, what's it like? Bin Laden had lived in Khartoum. So I went back. So I wasn't stitching together a lot of trips. I took a continuous trip. Then I took a return trip in October 2001, about a month after 9/11. And when? I went to South Africa. Then I went to Ethiopia. Then I went to the Sudan. Then I came home. I got seriously ill, actually. I think it was the Nile water, but it could have been something I ate in Ethiopia. Whatever it was, I had a parasite.
The second trip.
Yeah, second trip.
Because I saw you after the first trip, and you were fine.
Yeah. And after the second trip, I was sick for 5 months or so with some kind of intestinal parasite that became malabsorption syndrome. I was basically just wasting away, and I was really, really worried. Nothing is more demoralizing than being ill and being ill for months. But I was writing the book at the same time. I took all kinds of things for it, Cipro, Flagyl, every antibiotic, had, you know, numerous tests and so forth, and then it just mysteriously cleared up. So I wasn't stitching together a lot of trips. A person can go from Cairo to Cape Town. The main problem is the Sudan, getting into it, getting out of it.
The scariest part of the book are those trips where you're going overland in areas where people say, don't go, danger, danger.
Yeah, they don't say that. There are bad people. There are bad people there. What do you mean, bad people? They're bad people. They're very bad people. Bad people there. Which bad? What kind of bad? How bad? No, don't go there. They're bad people. So I got there are bad people there every so often. That's a worry if a local person, you know, if someone says to you, don't go to this part of California, there are bad people there. You're from California. I'm not going to go. When you're traveling and you're alone and you have no one to verify, you have to make decisions. Am I going to go? So you just get a second opinion and then put your head down and do it. I was resolved not to get on a plane. I hate planes. I didn't want to go on a plane. I wanted to stay on the ground and I wanted to cross borders. It's the only way you understand a country. Go to the hinterland, wait at the border, go across the border, continue. I will say that in traveling in Africa, the further south you go, the easier it gets. The more straightforward it is. The roads in Ethiopia, they're not bad. They're not bad. But there's quite a lot of traveling. Kenya, they're pretty bad. Uganda, they're not too great. I had to beg and plead to get across Lake Victoria on a boat. I don't mind being on a slow train as long as I'm on a train. I mean, the train was, you know, days late in Tanzania, but I don't care. You know, I have all the time in the world. I don't have another job. I didn't go to internet cafes. I didn't have a pager. I didn't have a phone. I mean, I was out of touch. I was just drifting. And that's also the best way of doing it.
Did you get robbed on the first trip or second?
Second. Second trip, I got to South Africa, and I thought, I want to go back to Mozambique, check it out. You know, I have a nice watch, and I had some extra money, and I had bought my wife some Tanzanites, which are expensive stones, clothes, and I don't know. I had bought a few artifacts. So I said to the hotel, well, I've got these valuables in the bag. What should I do? Put them in the strong room. They said, okay. I said, how many keys to the strong room? Only one. I said, okay, that sounds fine. So I put it in. When I came back, they couldn't find my bag. So all the stuff was gone. I mean, really a lot of stuff. But I had my passport. I had my notes. I had a briefcase, and I had my toothbrush. Actually, the interesting sequel of that is that I went from South Africa to the Sudan. So I went, when I went back into the Sudan, the guy said at customs, when I went in immigration, where's your bag? I said, this is my bag. And it was a briefcase, a little briefcase. He said, what's in it? I said, nothing really. You know, I got a toothbrush and I got nothing really. And he said, that's all you have, you Americans? I said, here's my problem. I said, I was in South Africa and I was robbed. No. I said, yeah. He said, yeah. And then he said, that's terrible. So he was very sympathetic, this Sudanese guy. And he said, oh, that's terrible. He stamped my passport. And he said, oh, how can we help you? I said, you can help me, just point me in the direction of Khartoum. Okay. So very understanding. Being robbed is something that happens in places like that. I didn't expect to be robbed in a hotel, you know, my bag taken from the hotel. I expect someone in the street to stop me and say, you know, where are money on two legs? Conspicuous, give me your money. But that didn't actually happen.
Paul Theroux, on a trip like this, one of the differences is that you had been in Africa when you were much younger. You speak Swahili?
I speak Swahili reasonably well, and I speak Chichewa, which is a language spoken in Central Africa, Malawi. And it's a lingua franca in Southern Africa. I speak it very well. I was in the Peace Corps. I had to learn it. I lived in the bush, and I made a study of it, and it stuck with me, you know, 40 years, because it was one of the first languages I learned. It's in my head.
So during the planning for this trip, you, in a sense, had a leg up on a lot of your other trips because you knew the language to begin with, and you knew, to some degree, the terrain.
To a certain degree, it was simpler in that respect. I was going back to places that I knew, but also a lot of places I didn't know. I'd never been down the Nile, I had never been to the Sudan or Ethiopia. Ethiopia was a real eye-opener. That's a place I would gladly go back to. I hadn't been to South Africa. So it was both familiar places and also strange places. But knowing the language, knowing English is a help.
You said just a second ago that Ethiopia is an eye-opener. What do you mean by that?
Ethiopia is a great country. It's an ancient country. It's a literate country. They've had a written language for yonks. I mean, I don't know how they're back the written language goes, but I would say into the dawn of time. They have Jews, they have Christians, they have Muslims, they have great churches, they have walled cities, they have, you know, rigid beliefs, they have a lot of pride. Many of them say, we're not Africans, we're Ethiopians. We're Ethiopians. They had a king, they had strife, they had a successful battle against the Italians. They beat the hell out of the Italians in 1893, the Battle of Adowa, one of the first, you could say, anti-colonial battles, whooped the Italians' ass. So much so that when the Italians came back, they were dropping poison gas on the Ethiopians and, Mussolini determined to suppress them. And then, naturally, they won. It was a superior in arms and poison gas. So the Ethiopian pride, history, culture, niceness, good manners, it's not an easy country to travel in, but they've got everything. And they've had war, so the war has eroded them. They're trying to get out. You go to the post office in Addis Ababa or any large town, it's just mobbed with Ethiopians sending letters to get into the lottery so that they can get a visa to come to the States. There's no money in Ethiopia. It's very kind of demoralized in those terms. And they've had a number of crummy governments. I mean, the Haile Selassie was no great sheikh. So he put a lot of people in prison. Then Mariam after him put people in prison. Whenever you go to Ethiopia, if there's a room full of Ethiopians, let's say there's 12 there, 8 of them will have been in prison and spent long times in prison under various regimes. I think it's a great place. I hadn't been there before. I'd lived in Africa for 6 years and always wanted to go, but I didn't have any money then. I mean, in the 60s, I was just an underpaid school teacher and couldn't travel.
You're listening to an interview with Paul Theroux, whose travel book is Dark Star Safari. Paul Theroux, the African experience as a whole, I interviewed Chris Abani, who's a Nigerian writer now. There are several other very good young new writers coming up out of Africa, and they all seem to tell the same story, which is corrupt government, people just trying to survive, constant overthrows. A new government comes in, everybody cheers because the prisons are opened, knowing full well that the old Who song, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, is going to be true. Torture everywhere. You've traveled through it. Is this because of colonialism? What is this part of the African experience?
I don't know. I wasn't traveling with a political intention, but inevitably you're always talking to people. I mean, half the people I met who were articulate, nice, friendly, journalists, teachers, old friends of mine, had been in jail. They had suffered through so many horrible regimes and been humiliated by them. Why does this happen? There are a number of reasons this happens. One of the reasons is donors. Donors want stable governments. Donors prop up these things. The World Food Program is giving money to Zimbabwe. Okay, Zimbabweans are hungry. They used to be able to feed themselves until Mugabe completely screwed things up. Now the World Food Program is giving money. They say, well, you know, we're helping people. Well, they're also helping Mugabe. Mugabe is a complete bastard. He has destroyed the economy. He's demoralized the people and curtailed the freedom of the press. A lot of donors are not giving him money, but certain ones are giving him money. You name a government and someone's giving them money, or there's an NGO. I'm actually in favor of no aid, no NGOs. Let the people realize, say, the people in Kenya, northern Kenya, which is not administered by Kenya, but by Catholic missionaries, Oxfam, move them out. Let people get rid of their government. Well, they did. They voted Arap Moi out in Kenya. After hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that had been given to Arap Moi in Kenya, the new government a year or so ago said, in order to get this country back on its feet, we're going to need a lot of money. They have had a ton of money. So they said, we need money to rebuild the country. Well, they'd have it. What happened to all that money? So you say, why is all this happening? I think it's connivance between local rats, crooks, thugs who get in and don't want to leave, conniving with donors or other people who are just feathering their own nests. That's what I'm guessing. I don't really know. Some of them get voted in. Mugabe got voted in an election that had been questioned, but they say that was a rigged election. His opponent, a guy called Morgan Tsvangirai, is still a member of the opposition. I will say this. Going as a traveler, if you're traveling through Africa on the road, not hanging around the capital, but you go through the country, through the Ethiopian wilderness, the Kenyan, northern Kenya desert, Samburu land, then you go south, then you go west into the edge of Uganda, which is the highlands and ruinous, and across Lake Victoria to the edge of Tanzania, where there's nothing. Well, there's a lot of people, but there ain't no tourists there. You do that, you find out how people live and what they're doing and what they care about. And what's happening and what you discover is they're not getting any aid. They're not getting any help. No one cares about them. No one's taking pictures of them. They're not reported in the paper. But they're living. They're surviving. Because in Africa, to survive, you need to understand subsistence. The majority of people in Africa are ignored by aid agencies. And you know, they're not driving Mercedes. They're just living the way they lived when they were first observed by Sir Richard Burton and David Livingstone and all that. They're just, you know, pounding maize and building mud huts and living. They're not working in sweatshops making widgets. If they were in sweatshops making widgets, then they'd be on some GNP chart and they'd say, oh, they're doing very nicely, aren't they? Well, they're not doing that. And it's one of the places where it ain't happening.
So it's not so much colonialism over there, it's something else.
It had been. The history of colonialism in Africa was that they redrew the boundaries. So they drew a boundary through a tribal area, you know, the Simbatabili land. So there's Ndebele people on one side and on the other side, but it's Mozambique and Zimbabwe. So it didn't observe tribal areas, nations.
Right, boundaries.
Yeah. Essentially, nations, yeah, a chief of a nation. Suddenly, half of it's Portuguese, the other half it's Indian. Portuguese did a crap job. They said they were colonialists. They were basically just exploiting Angola. 500 years of colonialism in Angola, for example. What did the Angolans get out of it? Nothing. What did they lose? Diamonds, chrome, gold, silver. And the Portuguese were up there in Lisbon living it up and cutting diamonds and selling diamonds to the Brussels Diamond Exchange. And Angola, there's no road. Now there's no roads. You can't even travel in Angola. After 500 years of theoretically, you know, uplifting. I mean, colonialism, we know, is a racket. But to observe how much of a racket it is, you have to actually travel by road through Africa and see how these people were just exploited and used.
So you're talking about the legacy of colonialism combined with the idea that now we can help these people, but all we're doing is making it worse.
Well, I think making it worse. I should also say about Angola is that many of the African Americans in America can trace their DNA to Angola. People listening to this but this program of the African American, maybe Angolan. Highly like that they were Angolan. So many came from there. Or maybe Mozambican. Of course, in West Africa, too.
Sure.
But Angola is one of the places that's not mentioned too much. But I have been told by people who know that that's the homeland for many African Americans.
We have a situation where we have the legacy of colonialism, which is a looted continent, followed by now 45 years of individual states down there, which are being destroyed through the World Bank aid. You talk about Land Rovers, the aid workers and Land Rovers, who are the nastiest people in all of Africa.
Some are very nice, but they can be. Well, they're people on a trip. I mean, they're mythomaniacs, many of them. Some are doing or trying to do good work. But the question is, you see, I took this trip after 40 years of having first seen Africa. I joined the Peace Corps in 1963. I was a teacher in Africa. So 40 years ago, I was a teacher in Africa, in a rural part of Central Africa. And I'm 60 years old. I was about to turn 60. I want to go see what happened. What happens if 40 years of money, 40 years of aid, 40 years of volunteerism, 40 years of sending T-shirts and your old, you know, mattresses or whatever the hell people send there, what does it do? It's an interesting speculation. You say, well, do you keep sending there? And how has it helped Africa, or the Africa that I know? Because Africa is 53 countries.
Sure.
But the African that I know, what good has it done? You know, I didn't know what I'd find. For all I knew, I'd find prosperity and happiness. I didn't find that. And as a matter of fact, I think that 40 years of this effort has not made any difference at all, probably has done harm.
The story of your trip to Malawi, which was where you were, is just it's a horror story. It's a tragedy. You worked at a school. The school is crumbled. Every place you went, it's all crumbled. The good stuff is some of it went back to the bush, which is not that bad if, as you say, your rose garden has become a maize vegetable garden. That's okay. But everything else seems to have deteriorated.
Yes, everything on the wane. Because there's no fuel there. So in countries where there's no fuel, Haiti is actually a classic example. People cut down the trees. There aren't many trees in Haiti. There are very few good standing forests in Malawi. Most of the trees have been cut down. They've been cut down for fuel, and then when the trees are cut down, people farm the land. They grow maize and sell it because they need money. So they need extra maize, not just maize for themselves, but to take to the market. And the consequence of deforestation is obvious to anyone listening to this, me talking, is that when a hill has no trees on it and it rains, the mud washes down, it clogs the river, and there's flooding. So there's serious flooding all over Malawi during the rainy season. In my day, which wasn't very long ago, there were no floods. There were no serious floods. In 40 years, it's now a highly flood-prone monoculture. So having a tree planting program, which they used to have, even, you know, in my little day, as they say, we used to plant trees. We weren't cutting them down. But they had to. The price of fuel is so high, people do, and there's no alternative. People make charcoal out of it. They, you know, they cut the tree and then burn it and make charcoal and sell it. So it's hand-to-mouth society. But I would also say that it's not so much that they have bad governments, bad education, so forth. What I think the African story is that Africans can look after themselves. They know how to survive. They've survived very, very bad times. The era of slavery, the era of colonialism and exploitation, and now bad government, and now, you know, being encumbered with aid. But they've come through it. A lot of these places that I went to, what political geographers call failed states, they're not all in Africa. I mean, 28 of them are in Africa. But, you know, Afghanistan is a failed state, and Albania is probably a failed state, and parts of Yugoslavia are probably failed states. And, you know, if the truth were known, you know, maybe, I don't know. I don't like to think that Ecuador is, because I like Ecuador and I've been there, but it doesn't look like, it just looks like a tool of Occidental Petroleum and Halliburton. These are failed states. The government really doesn't have much control outside the capital. Government's in charge. People are driving around in nice cars supplied by foreign governments. They give aid so you can buy a Mercedes or whatever it is, a Cadillac. Outside the capital, it's just no man's land. It's anybody's property. So they let missionaries and aid people run the hinterland. And that's the way it's happened. But this all sounds like a dark and gloomy story. What I would emphasize is that traveling in Africa is enjoyable. It's fun. Not looking at animals, you can go look at animals, but just the pleasure of the freedom of it. I wasn't going looking for trouble. I went there because I was having my 60th birthday, and I thought, I just want to go someplace, take a long trip, and enjoy myself.
Paul Theroux, The Stranger at the Palazzo d'Oro, short stories.
All those stories are written about being 60. The main character in The Stranger in the Palazzo d'Oro is 60 looking back. The youthful stories are about time, not so much about being 60. The African story, the man is 60, and the last story, Disheveled Nymphs, the man is 60. They're all about age. Guys in their late 50s, up 60, make very bad decisions at times. Well, classically, it's a married man who runs off with a younger woman.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have a child, and then the woman says, I don't love you anymore, and by the way, I want the house. So there's that. And a bad decision at that age has a long tail, so it kind of wraps around. I thought, I want to write about bad decisions as a way of preventing myself from making one, maybe.
Just curious about the other two stories in here. One, the African story, and that long Catholic story.
That's growing up in Boston in the 1950s.
Yeah.
I had not written about the things I knew as a child, childhood story. I was trying to recapture that period that Judas memoir is about. And the African story is, I wanted to write something that was like an encapsulation of the history of South Africa, where a white guy abandons his family and then marries an African, and then she rejects him. It's sort of like the history of South Africa, is the way I say it. But he's also a writer. And there's a little personal stuff in there. That Etienne Leroux, whom I mentioned, was a real South African writer, wonderful writer. I mentioned him in Dark Star Safari briefly.
The last story, I kept thinking, this is like a little piece of Hotel Honolulu.
Yeah, it is like that. Actually, I've written three stories about lawyers, that's one. I'd like to put them together in one book at some time. One is, in Hotel Honolulu, there's a character called Lionberg who falls in love with a young woman.
Right, yeah, remember
that. That's one story. There's one called Bottom Feeders. It's in the collected short novels, and then there's this. And each one, the main character is a lawyer. One's a complete bastard, one's kind of sympathetic, and one's just kind of sad, but they're all lawyer stories.
You've been listening to an interview with Paul Theroux, whose latest books are Dark Star Safari, Overland from Cairo to Cape Town, and a collection of stories, The Stranger at the Palazzo d'Oro. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.